Good morning. How's everybody doing this morning? It's Super Bowl Sunday, right? Yeah. You know, I love to watch football, but I don't have a lot of time with school and stuff and that. And what time is the game today, by the way?
Six,
so I got plenty of time. We're all right. That's okay. No, I won't go quite that long. I'm just kidding. Starts now, probably. Well, we'll try for there. That'll be our shot, 2 o'clock. So, you know, last time I had the opportunity to come and teach was on discipleship, and I have to be honest with you, it was rough for me. I don't know about y'all. It was a tough series to do with Brett. Stepped on my toes a lot. So this time, Brett kind of said, Gary, you're going to teach, and you get to pick what you want. And so I've been thinking about this for the last couple of months, actually, and I thought, Lord, let me pick something easy on folks and myself, you know, and something that's exciting. So let's talk about faith. And I thought, you know, I want to pick the heroes of the faith, something really good. We can get into this. And I thought, Lord, that'll be good because then it won't step on my toes and it won't step on everyone else's toes and we'll just have a good time. Well, it was a rough series to prepare for, let me tell you. I had a tough time. Because God asked me a lot of questions, and I didn't like it. But that's okay. It's good, because I had to answer them. So I've had the opportunity to study a lot on some of the heroes of the faith that are in Hebrews chapter 11. That's that great hall of faith, right? Those heroes that came before us. And I've had the opportunity to write a number of papers on some of these guys and ladies and that, and I thought, let's do something there. That'll be good. And as I studied some more, I thought to myself, you know, God, what does it take to be inducted into Hebrews 11 as a hero of the faith? What does it take for these guys to be mentioned in Hebrews 11? What are the qualities that they have that defines them as a hero of the faith? So that, you know, when I'm looking at people, I want to know who the heroes of the faith are in my midst today. Who are those heroes that are here today? Now. Right here. And you know, as I got started, I realized there are some things I wanted to do, which I tend to do. I like to define terms. So I thought, God, we need to look at faith. How do you define faith? Well, He did it for me in Hebrews 11, verse 1. Which reads, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Faith is pretty simple. What do we hope for? What do we place our hope in? What is it that we didn't see that we're certain of that is the basis of that hope? That thing that is the basis of our hope is the cross of Christ and what He did there. And the hope that we have is yet future, is a future resurrection in Him, that we will be resurrected to an eternal life that is sin-free. We will stand before God holy and blameless as His children. That's something to hope in. Faith. Simple stuff. So I looked at Hebrews chapter 11, and there's a bunch of heroes in Hebrews 11, right? So I listed them all out for us. You've got Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Rahab, Barak. Everybody knows Barak, right? Samson, Jephthah. That's a name, Jephthah. Everybody knows Jephthah, right? He's a hero of the faith. David, King David, we all know him. Samuel, the one who anointed him to be king. So I looked at this list of heroes and I thought, Lord, you know, let's just pick one. Who should we pick? The truth is, y'all don't get to pick. I had to pick already, otherwise the slides would be all wrong. So I picked one that we probably wouldn't be familiar with. My man, Jephthah. I like Jephthah. Jephthah's a cool guy. Because he's got a great name. Jephthah is in Hebrews 11 because he's a hero of the faith. So I thought, well, let's look at Jephthah's story. But before we look at his story, we need to understand some background to Jephthah and where he's contained. Yeah, I'm going to be all over his name all day because I just love to say it. Jephthah. He's in the book of Judges. Judges chapter 11 is where his story's written. You'll find him two other places mentioned briefly. 1 Samuel 12 and here in Hebrews 11. And that's it. He gets one chapter in the Bible. Yet he's put in Hebrews 11 as a hero of the faith. So coming up to Jephthah, what we've got is you look at Moses leads the people out of slavery. God calls Moses. They're led out of Egypt to the promised land. Joshua takes over as head of the nation of Israel, and he leads them into the promised land, and they conquer the land and the people there. And they take control of what will become the nation of Israel. So that's leading up to Judges. Now in Judges chapter 1, first verse says, Joshua is dead. So we have this transition now from Joshua into the book of Judges. The people have seen amazing miracles done on their behalf by God. And in Judges chapter 1, you have continuing conquest of the land. And then we get to Judges chapter 2. And the most important verse of the entire book, Judges 2 verse 10, which reads, "And all that generation also, those who went with Joshua into the land, were gathered to their fathers. They died. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that He had done for Israel." You see, that generation of Joshua failed to tell those coming up behind them what God had done for them in the conquest of the land. What He had done for them while they wandered in the desert. They failed to teach them about God. And what you have then recorded in the book of Judges is this downward spiral into pagan idolatry. So when we get to the story of Jephthah, I don't want you to be too surprised what we're going to see. Because I'll be honest, it's not pleasant. Yet remember, he's our hero. So let's look at Jephthah. Jephthah the man. I'm going to give you a synopsis of the first 28 verses real quick and real easy. Who is Jephthah? Judges 11:1 says that he was a mighty warrior. That's the first thing that's said about him. You know what's funny? That's not going to come until verse 33. But it's how the author wants us to remember him. As a mighty warrior. He was the son of a prostitute, the next thing we're told about him. Then his father, after having him with a prostitute, goes out and marries another woman, has a bunch more kids. And as they grow up, the kids realize, hey, Jephthah's the oldest among us. That means he's the one who's getting daddy's inheritance. And you see, he's the black sheep of the family. He's the son of a prostitute, so we don't like him. So Jephthah, guess what? You need to go, buddy. You see, we don't like you here in our town, Gilead. Because you're not like us. You're the son of a prostitute. You're the black sheep of the family, buddy. You got to get out. So guess what he does? He leaves. He just gets up and walks off. So Jephthah's life hasn't been simple. So what he does is he goes up and he lives into the hill country around Gilead. Now some of your Bibles may say that he joins with adventurous fellows. Really, that's how some of them read. The truth is, the way it reads is there were a bunch of crooks and robbers that he teams up with. And he becomes not only one of them, but the rebel leader. He becomes the big dog of the rebels in the hills. He sets up posts along the highway and starts collecting his own taxes. And life is good for him. Well, eventually what happens in the story is that the king of the Ammonites comes to Gilead and says, "Look, when y'all entered the land, this was really our land. We know someone else was living here at the time, but it's ours, so y'all need to leave. Otherwise, we're going to come in and we're going to kill you." And he leaves and gives the Gileadites time to pack up and leave. Well, they realize, we don't have a general. We're a bunch of farmers. We need someone who has experience leading men, who has experience fighting. Jephthah. So these folks who had kicked Jephthah out of town went to him and said, look, we want you to be our general, our leader, our commander. Come command our army. And Jephthah says, you want me to command what? Your army? A bunch of farmers? No, I don't think so. Do you not remember I'm the son of a prostitute? You didn't like me. You kicked me out. I left. Why should I come and lead you? So the Gileadites leave and they realize, king of the Ammonites is going to come in here. He's going to kill us. We need Jephthah. So they go back and they say, look, buddy, we're going to sweeten the pot a bit. We want you to be the general. But not only that, but when you return from war, because you will be victorious, because we believe God's going to be on your side. When you return, we'll make you the leader of Gilead. So Jephthah thinks about it and he says, okay, general, and basically mini-king, and I can collect taxes legally. You got it! I'm all in for it! And that's where we lead up to the story that we're going to really look at. So this is Jephthah up to this point. Not the best life. He's had a hard time of it. So in verse 29 in Judges chapter 11, 29 in the first part of 30, it reads, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. This is a phrase you see over and over and over in the book of Judges. And here's what it means, basically. When the Spirit of the Lord comes upon someone, that someone then gets up and they go out against the enemy of the Lord and they wipe them out. That's what happens. So it reads, he crossed Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. And we should expect the next phrase to say, and he kicked some butt. But he doesn't. Instead, he says, and Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. No, Jephthah, what are you doing? You don't understand. You see, this is the way it works. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon you. You've been called. You go out. You do. You beat them. You come back victorious. Yay. But he makes this vow. Why? You see, there have been a ton of judges already. Judges 2:10. They're not telling each other what's going on in their lives. They're not telling the story that God's writing for the nation of Israel so that future generations wouldn't make the same or worse mistakes. So let's look at Jephthah's vow. Verses 30 and 31. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, if you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's. He's going to dedicate whatever comes out to the Lord. And I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. Well, that's weird. What's he expecting to come out that door? See, it can be translated as gate. So we'll say gate. So let's say it's a gate. So what's going through Jephthah's head here? I'm coming home. I'm victorious. The gate opens. What, his favorite goat comes out? What's he expect? What do men returning home from war expect when they return home? We're not going to know what he expected. It doesn't say. We'll find out what happened. So let's look at the battle. Judges 11, 32 through 33. Then Jephthah went over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. He devastated 20 towns from Aroer to the vicinity of Minnith, as far as Abel-Karamim. Thus Israel subdued Ammon. Let me tell you, it had nothing to do with his vow. It all had to do with the fact that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah to run the race God had set for him, which was to judge Israel and their enemies. But he made this rash vow, as some call it. I call it, let's make a deal. So his return home is recorded in verse 34. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of tambourines? She was his only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. Old boy's in a bind now, isn't he? His vow was to dedicate whatever came out that door to the Lord and to offer it as a burnt offering to God. So let's look at his response to when she comes out that door. Verse 35. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and cried, "Oh, my daughter, you have made me miserable and wretched because I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." Sounds kind of funny, really, when I first read it. I thought of Adam and his sin. And what was his response to God? "God, it wasn't me. It was that woman you gave me." See, he's trying to place blame on who? His daughter. "You made me miserable because you had to come out that door." No, Jephthah, you made the vow, buddy. You're the one that tried to play games with God. If that's weird, it's going to get weirder. Let's look at her response. 36 and 37. "My father," she replies, "you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But grant me this one request. Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends, because I will never marry." What? I'm thinking that's strange. That's not quite what I expected. Why does she go so willingly? She goes to the hills, we're going to read later, which is where it would have been done, in the high places. It's where the altars would have been placed. She's getting ready. She knows what's going to happen. Why? Well, you see, archaeologically, we have evidence that shows us exactly what's been going on at this time period. You see, let's take the king of the Ammonites and let's assume he had won the battle. Typically, what would have happened then as the general, he would have returned home, and because of victory, he would have sacrificed one of his children to his God. To say, "Thank you." And you know what's really strange? Is these children we have recorded go willingly because they see it as a service to those people that this God was aiding, the Ammonites. Wow, that's really strange. But what has happened is, you see, the priesthood is a shambles at this point in time. Jephthah is probably 250 years into the period of Judges, if not further. The priesthood isn't teaching Israel what it means to worship God. So Israel, Jephthah, looks around and says, "I know Yahweh. I love Him. He is my God. He is my children's God, my wife's God, my people's God. He is my God." But what does that mean? How do I worship Him? They don't know. So what do? They look at the culture around them. They look at the Ammonites and say, "What do y'all do?" "Well, we'll do that, I guess. Everybody's doing it. That's what we'll do." So we shouldn't be surprised that Jephthah has taken pagan idolatry and placed it into his Jewish faith. It's unfortunate. And it's hard to read, particularly as a father who has a daughter. I can't imagine. Judges 2:10. It's happening. So let's look at the rest of the story, verses 38 to 40. "You may go," he says, and they let her go for 2 months. She and the girls went into the hills and wept because she would never marry. After the 2 months, she returned to her father, and he did to her as he had vowed. And she was a virgin. That's weird. Why has he got to put that in there? What's the narrator trying to say? Well, let's think it through. If I want to make a sacrifice to a God and I want to make it good, you make it a virgin. That's really pagan. Now don't forget, Jephthah's our man. He's our hero from Hebrews 11. Getting uncomfortable, are you? It's all right. You should. This should make you uncomfortable. Really. I mean, think what he's done here. This isn't good. This was detestable to God. He was disgusted by the actions of Jephthah. Disgusted. And this is the story God wanted to make sure we saw of Jephthah. This is what He gave us. God inspired Judges, and He inspired Hebrews 11. I know some of you are probably sitting there going, man, Gary, you're killing me. You know, maybe this whole school thing ain't working out for you. Because I'm just not seeing the connections. Right? I know some of you is like, where are you going, buddy? You need to help me out. Sorry. Because you see, He is in Hebrews 11. He is a hero of the faith. Right now you're going, whatever. I know a hero of the faith and He ain't it. I'm telling you, I'm not saying it. I'm not telling you He is a hero of the faith. He is in Hebrews 11. I didn't write it. God did. God's calling Him. God's the one who commended Him as a hero of the faith. Not me. You see, here's the thing. What happened in His life? The Spirit of the Lord came upon Him. God called Him to do something. And He did that thing, knowing in a hope that God would deliver Him through that thing. He had a hope in God that He would one day be made perfect. He had that. That made Him a hero of the faith. Now, I mean, we look at the story of Jephthah and we say, man, you're in there with guys like Abraham. Does Jephthah have the right to stand shoulder to shoulder with Abraham? Abraham, the father of the faith. A man who offered his wife as though he were his sister to another man to be that man's wife. Abraham, the hero, the father of our faith. How about Moses? The man God called to lead His people out of slavery. Yet at the end of the life, didn't treat God as holy and was disobedient. And because of his disobedience, God took his life and did not allow him to enter the promised land. Moses. David. King David. A man after God's own heart. A murderous adulterer and a failed father. King David. Samson. Come on, Samson's got to have something, right? This is God's strong man. No, he's just a self-centered skirt chaser. That's Samson. What's up with Hebrews 11, God? Well, the problem is that we take these Old Testament saints and we put them on pedestals that God never intended for them to be placed on. And you see, God records for us stories about these men that shows them they're no different than anyone in this building. They're real men who live in a fallen world, who are going to be tripped up and entangled in sin. We do the same thing. Hebrews 11 finishes in verses 39 and 40 with this. These, all those listed in Hebrews 11, were all commended for their faith. We may not see much of it in some of their lives. Yet they were commended by God for their faith. Yet none of them received what was promised. God had planned something better for us, those of us in this building right here, right now, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. You see, our hope is something yet future, that perfection that God has set for us. The basis of that is the cross of Christ. I know some of you are probably still going, I'm not sure, Gary. So who are these heroes of the faith? Abraham, Moses, Joseph, Isaac, King David. Who are they? Sarah, Rahab. God didn't leave the ladies out. They're people that God's called to run a race, no different than you and I. And you see, I believe, after really studying Hebrews 11 and some of these folks, that if I had to ask, who here deserves to stand shoulder to shoulder with Abraham, Moses, David as heroes of the faith? You might have to reevaluate that question now. Who are the heroes of the faith? You see, we tend to look at faith and say, it's someone who doesn't make mistakes. That's what I want to say. But I can't do that for any of the guys listed in Hebrews 11. I just can't. And it wouldn't be honest to do that. You see, faith isn't works, folks, right? Because then all of a sudden salvation isn't by faith, it's by works. Yet we want to look and say, that's a person of great faith. Why? Because we don't see him making a lot of mistakes. And that's not it. I've rewritten Hebrews 11:1 to make it personal for us. And if you can say, I am sure of what I hope for, a future resurrection in Christ, that I might stand before God holy and blameless, if you can say that, and you can say that I am certain of the things that I do not see, I am certain of the cross of Christ and the sacrifice that was made for me. I am certain of that. I am certain that today as I stand here, Hebrews 10, where it says, God has forgiven my sins and He remembers them no more. I am certain of that. And that gives me a hope of a future resurrection. If I can say that, if anyone here can say that, guess what? You're a hero of the faith. That's what it takes. So what? The problem is, Hebrews chapter 12 in the first three verses says, therefore, which means there's more to this faith thing than just having that hope and that. God's called us to a little more than that. He doesn't expect us to be like Jephthah. That's a bad example, all right? Don't be thinking no funny stuff. Or David or Moses or any of them, they make mistakes. Just because they're written doesn't make it the way we should live. Hebrews 12, verses 1 through 3 reads, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, those heroes of the faith that we have for us as examples, let us throw off everything that hinders us and the sin that so easily entangles us, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of your faith, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. The fact is, folks, you live a life here on this earth which is surrounded by the fall. You can't get away from it. The fact is, life will fall in on you at some point in time, if not daily. Sin will trip you up. Let me tell you, we have an adversary. And he wants to write your story. Satan wants to write your story. He wants to throw that sin out in front of you, watch you fall over and sit there and go, oh, I can't get up. I'm stuck in my sin. That's what he wants. You know why? Because then the race that God set out before you ain't happening. You give up. But instead, God said, you know what? This is what you need to do. Consider the cross. You know it happened. Be certain of it. And have a hope in a future that is yet to come. And when you can do that, and you look at Jephthah's story, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him and was able to run the race. Know that everyone in here who has placed their faith in Christ, the Spirit of the Lord has come upon you so that you can run the race God's called you to. Everyone in this building has a race set before them that God's called them to take. Question is, are you going to run it? Are you going to persevere? Now here's the truth. Because I fall down often. And I've learned that when I fall down, I can't be an American and say, I got to pull myself up by the bootstraps and just walk forward. No, what I've got to do is say, you know what, Lord? I'm weak. I can't do it. Your Spirit within me needs to strengthen me and pull me up. That's where my strength and power lies. That's where it comes from, so that I can run the race. You see, when we try and run the race on ourselves, we'll get entangled in the sin. and we'll get entangled in the life that's fallen around us. But when you lean on the Spirit that's within you, it's there all the time. He doesn't just come around sometimes. Other times, you know, flutter around. He's there. Always, in the midst of every difficulty, even the joys that you have, to help you run the race God set for you. I don't know what yours is. And I'll be honest with you, if you tell me your goal, your race is easy, I wonder. Because I'll be honest, I don't see it. I think everyone's race that they have before them calls them to a level they're unable to achieve. You cannot achieve it on your own. Because if you could do it on your own, what'd be the use in calling you to do it? Moses could never do on his own what God called him to do. He needed God within him to help him do it. Now, some of you I've talked to about my story. I was a shy, introverted, self-centered, unsure of himself individual. And when God said, "Gary, this is what I want you to do one day," I was like, "Buddy, you got to be kidding me. Something wrong with you because you don't know who you're talking to. That ain't me." And he says, "No, Gary, this is the race I have for you." And I'll be honest, I was like Moses in many ways because I argued with God often over this and said, "Lord, you know what? Listen, I don't like to get in front of 2 to 3 people and talk. He said, "Gary, you can't do it. And you need to understand that. Know that without me, you'll fail. You will never be what I've called you to be unless you lean hard on me." So what? What's God calling us to? What's your hope in? What does our faith bring us to do? Our faith should cause us to desire to run that race that God has set before us with perseverance and with endurance. But not only that, but there's a bigger story in Hebrews 11 that's often missed. Our faith should give to us a deep desire to make sure that the generations coming after us don't fall faint to Judges 2:10. Everyone here is called to tell their story. You see, Judges 2:10 doesn't say they didn't preach the gospel message. That's not it. It says they didn't tell the generations what God, the work God had done for them. That's your testimony. God's writing your story. And that's the story you need to tell the generations following after you so that they can learn what it means to lean on God and not lean on themselves. To not look around and say, "You know, they do this over here, culturally. Maybe it'd be okay if we did that." Or to look around and say, "You know, this whole Buddhist meditation thing, it's not much different than prayer. So maybe that's okay." We're called to protect the faith, folks. Each of us in this room and run the race. So this morning we're going to have the opportunity to take communion. And I want you to focus on the fact that God has given to you the grace that's necessary for you to run the race. We're going to come to a table that the Lord Himself prepared for us. He sets this table every time we come together. There may be human hands in the back behind what's here, but let me tell you, it's His Spirit that puts it here before us. So that we can focus on and remember the cross that's in our past with certainty and what's represented at that table by the blood and body of Christ. So that we can say, our hope lies on a foundation which is clearly secure. If I can have the usher.